Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 185 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Maximizing Farm and Family, about my recent conversation with Steve Henning, who farms outside of Thornton, Washington. That's Henning without an S at the end, as opposed to Hennings with an S for those keeping score. There's many of both families in eastern Washington farm country. A member of the Washington Association of Wheat Growers, whose executive director is Michelle Hennings with an S. Henning, no S, frequently participates with WAG during Olympia days. The two of us talked on June 19th, 2020 over a computer connection that's been a lifeline for this podcast. Although I don't think the audio quality is as good as an in-person interview, it's better than the average phone call. Last week in episode 184, I interviewed 40-year-old Andy Juris, a farmer from Klickitat County, where 10 inches of annual moisture is considered a good year. This week, you're hearing from Henning, where double that amount of moisture is about average at his farm near Thornton. These two farmers are 200 miles apart, but have dramatically different climates. It's that sort of variability in agriculture that policymakers often fail to consider, and it's why the battle cry of Washington farmers, whatever the commodity, has long been, one-size policy never fits all. There is, however, plenty that is similar between Juris and Henning's operations. Both are dedicated to the survival of their family farms, and both still work with their fathers. I wasn't planning on producing an episode for each man when I set out to interview them, but I changed my mind after our conversations. Only separate episodes could do them justice. I spoke with both men from a similar set of questions, and although their answers are different, everything they say is true. Henning is 46, an age I remember as personally rewarding, even if it is 20 years in the rearview mirror. Imagine. Before we get to the show, a note. I have posted another bonus episode on the WGC website at wagrains.org. It's episode 23, called Shepherding a Grain Connection, about Shepherd's Grain, a group that, among other things, identity preserves Pacific Northwest wheat for domestic flour consumption. Click on podcasts in the drop-down menu at the top of the page and scroll down. I open my conversation with Henning the same way I opened with Juris. Only the ages have been changed. Is a 46-year-old who has been raised on much of the technology that is at the heart of farming today at an advantage over the 58-year-old who represents the average age of wheat farmers in the state? Or does the 58-year-old, given his years more experience, hold the edge?
Ooh, that's a tough question, Scott. You know, you have to look at the fact of experience and what kind of price tag do you put on experience. We have this debate all the time of, you know, technology definitely makes you money these days with the just the efficiency aspect of it and also the savings in inputs. But there's also been times when I go to the older generation and say, hey, look, what do you think about trying this? Because if you make the wrong mistake on a pretty big piece of acreage or an input, you know, you're looking at tens and thousands of dollars. So it could probably go hand in hand as far as, you know, which one's the advantage. Now, if you're a 58-year-old and savvy on technology, then you probably have the upper hand because, you know, I tell people all the time, you never stop learning in this industry or in life altogether.
So are you still working with your father or are you working on your own?
Yeah, no, I'm in a partnership with my dad, 50-50 joint venture. We were in a third. I was farming with my dad and my uncle, and he passed away in 2009. So I'm on, I started back here in 2003. So my uncle passed away in 2009, and then it just is down to my dad and I, and now the boys are starting to integrate in as well.
All right. And what kind of technology do you use that your father may not?
I would say the biggest one, Scott, has to be cell phones. He is so stuck on this military grade flip phone that he's probably had for 15 years, and we just keep buying batteries for it. And I'm sure eventually they're going to force us out of it altogether and make him go to a smartphone. It's funny because he's adapted fairly well to the technology on the tractors with the GPS, but for some reason he's really digging his heels in on this phone issue. So I'm probably going to stick with the answer of his good old fashioned flip cell phone.
Well, he can't listen to my podcast on his flip phone.
Very true. Very true. I'll be sure to mention that to him as well.
All right. So what is the average precipitation on your farm, and what would you describe your farming practice as?
Yeah. So we're in Thornton, right along the Highway 195 there. If you've driven past Rosalia and down into Colfax and into Pullman, you've driven pretty much right by a pretty good chunk of our land. We're in that 20 inch rainfall zone. We're right on the border to it used to be the old fashioned border, I guess they call it, of the fallow to continual or annual cropping. Over east of us, 195 was always the dividing zone. We're in a 3-year rotation of pretty much winter wheat and spring cereal, growing a lot of food barley lately for our spring cereal, and then fallow. We're I guess you call it nowadays reduced tillage. It's probably borderline on a direct seed, but more of a reduced tillage. We're still using some tillage in our operation right now, and trying to use that as a tool in the toolbox here with some of the issues that everybody's facing right now with weed resistance and just using it as an IPM, integrated pest management.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm interested. Food barley. I mean, I don't come across many farmers who are growing food barley. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is spearheaded by McKay Seed up in Elmira, and we've been in it with them for probably about the last 8-10 years, pretty strong. It's been a learning curve, I think, for everybody that's growing it. But, you know, we always have barley in our rotation as a tool that kind of worked hand in hand with the rotation that we're in. Has a lot of benefits to the soil and cleaning up the ground a lot. And this brought some profit back into having barley in your rotation. You know, for the longest time there, we were almost spinning our wheels with regular feed barley, and this really brought the profit back into it again. So it's a market they developed. A lot of it's going overseas to Japan. They're supplementing with rice for nutrition, and it's kind of a niche market, but it's working well for us in this area.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, Steve, is it just me, or do we seem to be having heavier spring rains?
You know, Scott, it's interesting. I remember as a even when I was younger, of it seems like there was always some storms that would roll through and hit somebody somewhere. Joke always was, with a big old hailstorm or the old fashioned, they call it the old white combine, would come through and just mow everything down, that it was a matter of closing your eyes and throwing a dart at a map, knowing that someone's going to get hit somewhere and somehow, and the severity of it, and kind of an odds game. So I don't know if I could really say that it's gotten worse. It's funny, some areas are more consistent than others as far as how hard they get hit or how consistently they get hit. And you know, every once in a while, someone will have a 1 in 10 year storm event. It seems like it does a lot of damage, and you know, which is always unfortunate. But I think that's that way anywhere in the world. And our storms are pretty tame compared to when you look in the Midwest with tornadoes or you know, flash flooding of magnitudes that look like the Amazon River running down the middle of a town. So
I haven't heard of the white combine since I interviewed some farmers in Montana, but in any case. Has having, you know, more moisture in the spring raised the possibility of changing any of your operations or rotations?
Not really, Scott. We've kind of, like I said, the 3-year rotation we're in has been working really well, and I'm always proud to share how well it's been working for our farm. And I know it's not for everybody and not for every place, because you know, I even know what even works here doesn't work 20 miles west of me, or, you know, let alone down in the Horseheaven Hills or anywhere. We're such a vast, you know, geographic area here that in this side of the state with any kind of farming, everybody does something a little bit different. But, you know, we're pretty much sticking with what works, and it's been working very well for us. And you know, the biggest part is maybe fine tailoring it here and there. You learn as you go down the road, and you know, the spring rains definitely help. Last year we really struggled, as I think everybody did, and with just the lack of moisture. You just need moisture to grow crops, and you know, this year we're receiving just the perfect amounts. It seems like that it's amazing what happens when you get some rain on your crop and how well it turns out.
Yes, and how late a crop can come back. I mean, it was a drought until that, what, mid-May?
It was scary dry. We have a really shallow piece right behind our shop that has a lot of rock on it. And it usually doesn't start showing signs of drought stress until end of June, 1st of July, and third week in April. My dad comes back and he says, wow, he goes, that's already drying up back there. And then when we were riding fields, we were noticing a lot of the marginal ground was starting to show some serious drought stress. So it was needing a drink bad, and it came at the perfect time. But also, you know, we felt that it sent the root down deep for moisture and established a pretty good root system. So, you know, everything kind of worked hand in hand, and it's amazing what happened when that rain came and then how everything kind of popped back. And you're looking like it's going to be a pretty good year this year so far.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, glyphosate has become so important in agriculture. I had a farmer tell me that his son wouldn't know how to farm without it. What about you?
Boy, that's scary, Scott. You know, back to this whole issue of weed resistance, and I know you've done a great job with your previous podcasts and even talking to professors down at the college about this, and I've had a lot of discussion with the different professors down there about this issue, as well as my cousins who farm back in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa and weed resistance. I feel like they've always been about 10 years ahead of us back there with any problems that happen. And they are fighting Palmer amaranth and water hemp so bad back there, Scott, that they are starting to incorporate tillage as part of a tool. Now, it's not the old-fashioned tillage that they used to do, but they said we are having to use this as a integrated pest management approach. And you know, with everything popping up even now here around the Palouse, I remember back in the day when 16 ounces of a 4-pound glyphosate would smoke anything. I mean, you could put it out there and pretty much everything would just be fried down to the ground. And now you're seeing guys with 5-pound glyphosate that are up in that 60 ounce to the acre rate and still struggling to control weeds. And you know, then you keep hearing stories about now Banville under scrutiny, or dicamba, I guess, more in general under scrutiny. And you know, paraquat's an option, but you look at the safety factors of that and what's involved. It's a scary subject for, especially you start getting your grassy weeds, your rat tail fescues, your downy bromes that are showing some resistance in areas. And from what I'm hearing, that when it hits, it's just a matter of time. It's going to come so quick that your head's going to be spinning. So I think everybody's going to have to be ready to be flexible to try to help combat this resistance problem.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be a huge problem. And as you say, it's coming like a runaway freight train. I've had farmers tell me that they make more money sitting at the computer than sitting in their tractor. The idea being that there are government programs which can help with their P&L. Do you make a point of ensuring that you have utilized every government tool?
I think definitely have always checked into every one. The thing that I've always stressed to people, as well as also NRCS when I talk to them, is the flexibility to possibly tailor to each farm. Goes back to our discussion we had here a few minutes ago about just the vast geography of this Eastern Washington and even down south, that what works well on one farm might not work at all in a farm 20 miles from here. And so, you know, it's definitely good to always check and see. You know, we've utilized some programs with some contour buffer strips on some hills that are just really, really steep, and they always pose problems for us. We've got some grass waterways we've utilized in some areas in the past that always caused some trouble with some runoff in severe times. And you know, definitely it's always good to stay on top of that, but for P&L, but I also feel that boots on the ground is makes you just as much money, if not more too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say that you came back to the farm in 2003. So you grew up on the farm, but then you left and came back. Trace your journey for me, would you?
Yeah. So left high school and went to school up at Spokane Community College. I took back then the program was agrochemical business management. I think it was. It was a great 2-year program that I felt would fit me really well. And completed that when I was going to school up in Spokane. Worked part time at a car dealership up there, one of the major Chevrolet dealerships up in Spokane, and kind of working in the service department, shuttling customers around. And I finished up my degree, and they made me an offer to sell cars. And I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. And then after about a year, I decided maybe I don't know if I was crooked enough or. For what? But I can say I was a car salesman in my life, and it was good, but it came with a lot of strings attached, and I was offered a job then about a year later with the McGregor Company down here in the Palouse, and started off as a serviceman and started to work my way up into the agronomy side of it when my uncle started having some health issues, and then we were able to expand some acreage on the farm, and I came back and bought in as a third partner and signed my life to the devil, and the rest is history. So,
all right. Okay. So, during that period of time from 2008 to 2012, when wheat prices were a lot better than they are now, did you think that this was the new normal, or, you know, how did those prices motivate you?
It was exciting at the time, Scott, and this probably goes back to another question we talked about with, you know, what's better, young age or experience? And it's funny because at the time when both my uncle was still alive and my dad told me, they said, we've seen more guys get in trouble in good years than they ever had in bad years. And, you know, taught me to use the good times as a tool to get strong again. So you can always put it neutral and coast when times get tough. And, you know, these last, I would say probably, you know, 8 years have been pretty trying as far as keeping the pencil sharp and doing what has to be done, but yet not neglecting things to the fact to where, you know, it costs you more money in the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what has it been like to live with the reality of sub $5 a bushel wheat?
It makes your time in the office very, very valuable. And, you know, for us, Scott, it's been an efficiency of not only the whole operation in general, but, you know, in the cropping systems that we have and maximizing bushels per acre. That's been, I think, the biggest thing for us trying to utilize is, you know, that your max net profit. And you know, a lot of things work. That you do, and then a lot of things too. You try it a little bit, and you experiment. And you say, "Well, maybe this is working." But we've always experimented with different things here, as far as trying to gain that efficiency and also, you know, maximum yield on the farm. And I think that's what you're going to see that people are going to have to adapt to get through these times, because, you know, I don't see the price of equipment going down anytime soon. It just keeps getting tougher and tougher, and that gap spreads wider and wider. And the answer always is not, you know, expanding acreage. You get to a point to where there's an inefficiency in that as well. So to me, it's maximizing what you have on your farm right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your family and, you know, how does your spouse contribute to farm and family life?
Well, I've been married for, it'd be 21 years here this October, and my wife, Heidi, works over at Oakdale School. She's an elementary teacher over there. She and my mom are what we always refer to as the glue of the operation. They're always contributing any way they can, and it seems like they're always tying up the loose ends. There's so many things that, even looking back on all the time, I probably take for serious granted of what they do, and especially behind the scenes things of, you know, running to get parts or making lunches or always keeping the laundry going, and it's all the little things behind the scenes that I always refer to as being the glue.
Yes, yes. And what about your children? Tell me about them.
Yeah. So Evan is a freshman at Big Bend. He just graduated last year from Oaksdale High School and completed his first year over there. He's taken the ag technology program over at Big Bend and had to adapt a little bit there when, of course, everybody was cut short on their spring semester. And he came back and helped with spring work and was noted of sitting on hilltops trying to get cell service so he could do his online classes while out working and helping with spring work. And then Ryan is a sophomore at Oaksdale and finishing his year up here this week. And so he'll be continuing on two more years of high school.
Wow. You're going to have to get a bigger farm,
a bigger farm and a bigger refrigerator. Scott, I forgot how my food bill was down a little bit. Now I have another grown man in the house that's eating me out of house and home. So I might be selling blood here pretty quick to pay for food.
Okay. You sort of alluded to this a little bit. For the last 3 months, parents of young children and not so young children across the nation have been dealing with the COVID-19 restrictions. How has the pandemic changed your farming operation and family?
You know, that's an interesting question, Scott. It was so odd to sit back and analyze this, especially after things have, I wouldn't say maybe settled down now, but we've gotten a couple months under our belt. And, you know, unfortunately, or I should say fortunately for us, we didn't have any major breakdowns this spring during spring work that affected us for having to go to town to get parts or service. But there was just looking at the whole social aspect of what happened and people getting thrown out of their routines that they had and just the social disruption of it really amazed me. It was almost eerie when we were right in the middle of spring work, usually working around 195. There is so much traffic anymore going up and down, and it was almost eerie to the point to where there was a few days, I wouldn't be surprised if there was more than 100 cars total going up and down that highway, to where usually there's 100 cars, you know, maybe a minute that are going up and down anymore, it seems like. You know, it the biggest thing for us, I think it taught us that I didn't realize how busy our lives were with the boys, both in extracurricular activities at the school. In these smaller schools, they're involved with everything from FFA to band to sports to Knowledge Bowl to NHS. And then especially then you start throwing in your AAUs in the mix, which it seems like most of these kids in these small towns are involved in, to where we were gone. It seemed like every second of the day to where this was done. And we're like, wow, everybody's here and we can sit and talk and have a conversation and utilized us quite a few sit down meals. It probably brought me back to the fact of that it didn't realize how busy we were and that it's okay sometimes to say no and concentrate more on family time and togetherness.
Yes, yes. Interesting. Now, not just about the pandemic, but in your life so far, what has been the most important lesson you've learned?
Oh, the most important lesson I've learned, I think, Scott, that I try to utilize is trying to work to solve problems and not create problems. And, you know, I learned that a lot when I went over with the groups to Olympia days and trying to educate, especially legislators from the West side, that not trying to fight them, but to try to educate and work with them. And I think a lot of people spend a lot of negative energy on creating problems and not working on solving problems. And I've found that that's been an effective tool, not only for politics or even for, you know, working with landlords on that aspect, but also just utilizing that in life in general. I wish more people in society would maybe take heed to that, and maybe we wouldn't be having some of the problems we're having today.
Yes, no kidding. So you mentioned that you're still involved with your father on the farm. What do you most admire about your father?
Well, he's 78 years old, and he is honestly still going to no end. And people ask me all the time, when's your dad going to retire? And I said, well, if you want to kill him, you can probably just take him off the farm and seclude him in a big city. He has zero desire to want to retire. probably his work ethic, Scott, of just not wanting to stop. And, you know, a lot of people aren't like that. They work to a point in their life and they say, you know what, I want to go and vacation or whatever. And that's probably been one of the big hangups with my mom. I think she would maybe like to do a little bit more of that. He feels like if he's not even in the shop at 7 a.m. in the winter time that he's missing something, or that, something could be going on that he's not a part of. But for the most part too, I mean, his physical shape that he's in is amazing for his age, but I think a lot of that attributes to his active lifestyle.
Henning's father probably doesn't know it, but his work ethic adheres to every bit of research conducted on quality of life and longevity issues. Studies have found an active lifestyle is the key to avoiding a myriad of chronic conditions, not to mention living longer. I hope you enjoyed episode 185, or what I entitled Maximizing Farm and Family. My conversation with Steve Henning, no S, who farms outside Thornton, Washington. If you've ever driven Highway 195 from Spokane to Colfax, you've passed his farm. Please join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It. Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.